on August the 3rd, 2017. This is Elizabeth Covett Caverly.
And this is Lou Caverly.
A lot is going on, and we have a lot of important good things to say about things coming out of the Trump administration. And, of course, we now have a new FBI director, Christopher Wray, so we'll have to see what that brings. We had analysis from Roger Stone insinuating that Rance Priebus was responsible for bringing in Rod Rosenstein to the second spot under Sessions, and that he was responsible for bringing Robert Mueller on board. But there are a lot of connections that are turning up about Mueller's connections to the Clintonian dynasty. So we'll have to watch all of this. And also there is more coming about the IT scandal with the Democrats and the Pakistanians who were over here. And so, you know, there are a lot of things we're watching, and we need to pray that God will foil the evil ones and that he will bring some justice, that there will be some indictments. One of the key things, Lou, though, is the ongoing real threat. There is no conspiracy involved in this whatsoever. We have to know that a human being on the planet Earth has to be concerned about this headline.
Headline reads, North Korea, no plan, only anxiety. And this is dated Tuesday, August 1st, 2017, from the Seattle Times. The tensions between the United States and North Korea grew more ominous and urgent last week. Americans should be rightfully concerned about the nuclear ambitions of the hermit state and diplomatic pratfalls in the Trump White House. A leak new assessment by the Defense Intelligence Agency speeds up the anticipated date for assembly line production of nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the West Coast and beyond. The Washington Post last week reported that North Korea is now anticipated to have that capacity, quote, sometime in 2018, unquote, not years from now, as has been assumed. As if that's not enough to induce midnight sweats, one of the regime's last major technical barriers to a war game scenario, war games in quotes, is the capacity for long-range North Korean missiles to survive atmospheric reentry. Kim Jong-un's military is now anticipated to break that barrier as early as, quote, this week, unquote, the Post reported. U.S. options for addressing the growing North Korean nuclear threat are all bad. Successive presidential administrations from Clinton onward have unsuccessfully pressured China to use economic leverage to rein in North Korea. Trump added bluster to that strategy, but he has been equally unsuccessful so far. Diplomatic sanctions expanded under Obama leave North Korea on an economic island, yet Pyongyang has undergone such a building boom that it has been dubbed Pyonghattan, with 18 towers at least 48 stories tall, built in 2012, and a, quote, grand new apartment complex nearly every year since, since Kim Jong-un's assumed power, unquote, according to the North Korea Watch blog 38north.org. Those failed strategies lead to talk of a military strike to wipe out the North Korean nuclear program. That is much easier to propose than to execute. As retired General Barry McCaffrey wrote in a Seattle Times op-ed this year, North Korea is, quote, an army wrapped in an impoverished nation, unquote, with 24% of its GDP devoted to the military and 21,000 artillery weapons aimed at the 25 million residents of Seoul. U.S. Representative Adam Smith, the senior Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, said it would be impossible to destroy that capacity in a single strike. and could trigger catastrophic retaliation against South Korea and Japan, as well as the 25,000 U.S. soldiers still based on the Korean Peninsula. Smith essentially recommends a new Cold War with North Korea, assure Kim Jong-un of his regime's destruction if he ever uses nukes. North Korea is clearly on a course to be the Trump administration's first crisis. That could mean another effort at international diplomacy, such as the six-party talks. A military strike must be the absolute last option. The nation waits as the doomsday clock ticks closer to midnight. And that was reprinted from the Seattle Times.
A lot of important things have been going on that aren't really being given much publicity, certainly not in the MSM, the mainstream news organizations. But here was an interesting column, July 26th, 2017, by Georgianne Geyer. Drama in White House hides victory in Mosul, Washington. The television news has been filled almost exclusively recently with stories about the, quote, terrible son of the president and his apparent flirtations with, quote, evil Russian officials right up in New York's Trump Tower. Yet, you could be forgiven for thinking there was no other news happening anywhere. On cable news networks, especially Fox and CNN, little else has been covered besides Donald Trump Jr., the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and various miscellaneous things trying to figure out their way out of a story that, shall we say, quote, engaged the media. What we are seeing is not a question of fake news, which is President Trump's imaginative creation that also exists in a Russian foreign ministry. No, it is that both major cable news networks, and many small ones too, have since Trump was elected featured about 90% speculation and opinion, by my calculation, rather than genuine news. Major world stories of historic importance get a once-a-day glance, if that. And as sad proof, I offer the ultimate victory over ISIS to retake Mosul officially on July 10th, a fight waged mostly by a refit Iraqi military. This world-shaking victory told us a lot about Iraq, but also a lot about ourselves. I admit to having a personal as well as a professional interest in this story because I went to Iraq as a correspondent in 1973. And again, listeners, this is Georgianne Geyer writing, and was the first Western correspondent to interview Saddam Hussein. And because I have visited Mosul and was thrilled to see the biblical lands, Babylon, Nineveh, that mothered both Christians and Jews, and also because I felt I knew the country developing rapidly, that we would make the terrible mistake of invading and largely destroying in 2003. But early this month, the new Iraqi army fought bravely and effectively, house to house and building to building, as it drove ISIS-crazed fighters from the ruins of Mosul. This was a remarkable turnaround from the battles of 3 years ago when the Iraqi army turned and fled. We broadcast that disgrace all over the world. Perhaps I'm an old-fashioned journalist, but I have to think that we Americans who tore up their country for nothing and now may have to stay for years to address the next acts of the drama at least owe the Iraqis the respect of soberly noting the dignity with which they are now behaving. But I am also professionally and morally obliged to add that newspapers have been doing a far fairer job at covering the fight for Mosul than has television. News is self-contained. It starts and ends, at least that day, in and of itself. It does not leap to the next question, for that is, by all journalistic ethics, the next day's story and or the realm of the opinion writer. We must, of course, address the problems facing Iraq and us. Poor Mosul is littered with buried explosives and munitions. Troops are finding booby traps in vacuums and ovens. Tens of thousands of people are still desperately trying to flee the ashes of the ruined city, once the second city of Iraq. When I look around the world, in some ways there's nothing like Mosul that we've encountered. Stanley Brown, the State Department official empowered to remove weapons there, told the Washington Post. The level of contamination, though, is not one of those where we're talking weeks and months. We're talking years and maybe decades. Then there's an even bigger problem. But this one is in the Iraqi military and the vast, endlessly troubled expanses of the Middle East, from Lebanon to the borders of Iran. The Persian Shiite militias, called Popular Mobilization Units and containing as many as 150,000 fighters, also fought bravely in Mosul and elsewhere, and they want very different things from the Iraqi army. The Shiites have already formed an overland resistance highway that would link Tehran to Damascus and Beirut directly and do away with, once and for all, the threat they have historically seen from Iraq. There will be many, many more stories from this part of the Middle East. There always have been. So for now, let's forget Donald Trump Jr. Let's give those same Iraqis we had given up on some credit for uncommon valor in a hellscape of the world. And, of course, Lou and I made a keystone of our broadcast in the earliest years we were on the air, our anti-war sentiments. We did not want Bush going into this illegal war. There really wasn't any yellow cake. And even though Valerie Plume was ruined her CIA career for being outed, all of these things didn't hide the gross abomination that this war really became. Abu Ghraib, we will never forget that. We just can't forget that, the abuses that were done. And so, you know, when we think about this, we now hear that they're thinking about putting some of the soldiers under private mercenary control. Now, I think this is important that we know about this. This came out on July 24th, 2017, from TNS. Lou, I think you'll tell us what happens here. And we would have to say from the get-go, we don't like this idea. We certainly don't want war continued. But we also know that companies like Blackwater, I think it's called Z now, all of these different hired guns played a role in the satanic things done there at Abu Ghraib. And we really don't like to see things done in the name of our country that we aren't part of. We voters, we people, the Tea Party people, even the libertarians, all the people who know that it was very, very wrong to harm all of these people in the Middle East under the name of bringing democracy to the world. Well, let's hear a little input here from John D. Michaels of TNS. Lou?
Fearful of repeating the foreign policy mistakes of the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, top Trump aides Jared Kushner and Stephen K. Bannon have recently turned to Eric Prince and Steven Feinberg for help. According to a report in the New York Times, Prince, the founder of Blackwater, and Feinberg, the CEO of the holding company that owns DynCorp, championing private military alternatives to a recommitment of uniformed personnel in Afghanistan. There is a lot going on in this still-developing story. Let's focus on two. First, if Kushner and Bannon don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past, why would they turn to two of the most prominent and controversial figures in private military contracting? Have they so quickly forgotten all the physical, operational, and diplomatic headaches contractors caused in Iraq and Afghanistan? All the instances of contractor fraud and overbilling to the tune of tens of billions of dollars? All the abuses, irksome and monstrous, including the flagrant disregard for the cultural sensitivities of the occupied people, the killing of unarmed civilians, and what the U.S. Department of Justice called a wartime atrocity, the degradation, humiliation, and even waterboarding of detainees. All the ways in which contractors alienated, even radicalized, local populations. Recall that the friendly governments we installed in Baghdad and Kabul insisted on Blackwater and its ilk leaving their countries. The criminal prosecutions, congressional investigations, administrative penalties, and, of course, Prince's hightailing it out of the United States in 2010, perhaps half a step ahead of the law. Moreover, have they forgotten all the ways in which an outsourced war is a perniciously unaccountable one, divorced from our democratic military and its long inculcated values and commitments? And second, why are Kushner and Bannon formulating military strategy? Bannon and Kushner are reportedly intent on giving the president alternatives to the advice put forward by the likes of Pentagon Chief James Mattis and National Security Advisor H.I. McMaster. We've been down this road, too. Remember the George W. Bush's administration's kettle of chicken hawks? They squeezed out Secretary of State and former Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell from major policy decisions and often ignored the concerns of the military leadership. Yet folks such as Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz look like Sun Tzu and Karl von Clausewitz compared with Kushner and Bannon. Kushner has zero military or foreign policy experience. Bannon's experience has been confined to service as a junior naval officer and a short stint on the National Security Council before McMaster summarily removed him as utterly unqualified. On this issue, Kushner and Bannon ought to defer to Mattis and McMaster, two of the few Trump appointees who remain liked and respected. They are career senior military officers and reportedly want nothing to do with the private military CEOs, those whose involvement was all too apparent and destructive under Presidents Bush and Obama. We are far from closing the book on Iraq and Afghanistan, but whenever that book is written, one deeply unsettling chapter will tell the sorry tale of America's injudicious revival of the private military industry. Until recently, that industry was on the fast track to extinction, barely kept alive in the decades after World War II by unsteady warlords and petty dictators, insensitive to the otherwise universally felt revulsion towards soldiers for hire. It had lost its place in a rapidly democratizing and increasingly legally accountable world as modern states took the lead in cultivating national public militaries unmotivated by profits, attentive of the laws of wars, and ultimately tied to democratic projects, commitments, and aspirations. The cultivation of such democratic militaries helped raise the cost and stakes of going to war. We were not just paying mercenaries to do a job. We were sending our sons and daughters into harm's way, a proposition that, one would hope if not expect, kept the graybeards at the drawing boards and negotiating tables just a little bit longer. In the 1990s, however, the United States re-embraced military contracting, albeit on a small scale. And in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks, we found ourselves entirely reliant on contractors. At various times, these contractors outnumbered uniformed personnel in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Their presence, moreover, enabled us to continue and even intensify the occupations long after much of America stopped thinking about them. Sometimes war is inevitable, but the decision to engage military should remain the hardest decision a president has to make. Kushner and Bannon should remember that before presenting President Donald Trump with the seemingly easy option of dispatching contractors, especially since that initially pain-free path proved so agonizing the last time we took it. This was by John D. Michaels, and he's a professor at the UCLA School of Law.
when we take responsibility for the millions of people who were displaced, and of course, all that we set in motion indirectly led to the terrible persecution of Christians and the destruction of those sites that were there at the time of Jonah. All of the suffering and the displacement, we have to really think about that, because we were really back of it, a lot of it, with what happened. And for the people, I'm sure that any of those people in the Middle East, if they were to hear what former top leader Madeleine Albright said, that it was worth it for those hundreds of thousands of children to be killed, that doesn't represent my viewpoint as an American, and I'm sure it doesn't represent yours. And this program represents two Christian people who are watchmen on the wall, and we are bringing this program to you with practically no support. We do thank several listeners, two or three listeners, who helped us last month. And we do appreciate every amount that you can ever send to us, even if it's a $5 bill or a $1 bill. And let us give you our address if you would like to write us letters of encouragement or send a little contribution. It would be Lou, capital L-O-U, Caverly, capital C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem. And the town is like that little town in the Bible where Jesus was born. It's spelled capital B-E-T-H-L-E-H-E-M, Maryland, 21609. And again, that is Lou and Elizabeth Caverly, or just Lou Caverly at P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. When we think about what life really was like for those human beings, and they are human beings, we don't want to be what used to be called the stereotypical ugly American. And this was known, this stereotype, back in the 60s, with what our State Department was always doing and what the intelligence, the covert part of it, was doing, overthrowing nations, causing revolutions, all of these things that George Washington told us didn't belong with being America. So, in an odd place, in Glamour magazine, and I certainly don't subscribe to it, I subscribe to another little fashion magazine that went out of business about 2 years ago, so they just began to substitute sending me Glamour. And through this, I did note how they extolled Planned Parenthood, and they had the Women of the Year, and one of those Women of the Year last year was the head of Planned Parenthood, Cecile somebody. I can't remember her last name right now. But at any rate, there was some good truth-telling in it. In the one of the latest issues here of Glamour, and the title was Life with ISIS and After ISIS. So this is an eyewitness account. Hardly any acronym strikes more horror in American hearts than ISIS, the extremist group that boasts of bombing teens at concerts, driving trucks into holiday crowds, and beheading journalists. But in 2014, when most of us were first learning of ISIS's signature savagery, women in Iraq were already well acquainted. The militants were at their door. It was June of that year, and again, that is 2014, when ISIS captured Mosul, a city of 2 million that's the second largest in the country, in a move intended to establish a caliphate or Islamic State. Virtually overnight, according to reports, its gunmen roamed the streets and religious police lurked in the alleyways. Women who had worked as doctors and dentists and freely gone to school were forbidden from studying and allowed outside only if shrouded in black cloth, every speck of skin, including their eyes, covered. A forgotten glove or veil was suddenly punishable by beating with a stick. Many families lost their livelihoods and their men to prison. Phones and the internet were banned. Worse, these injustices were shadows of a much darker violence. Quote, ISIS has been a horror story, man, said one woman who managed to flee the city. We'd see corpses cut in two on the street. It was normal for children to play with severed heads. They've turned our neighborhoods into ghost towns. Nearly 3 years later, the terror lockdown has taken its toll on Mosul's civilians. Iraqi forces rallied to liberate the city last October, but the situation remains deadly. At press time, the massive liberation operation was still inching along with U.S. air support winning block by block, even as ISIS soldiers staked themselves out in people's yards, using the families as human shields. When photojournalist Aaron Trich, 35, arrived in Mosul for Glamour in mid-March, neighborhoods were erupting in gunfire and bombs screamed from the sky. Residents were terrified that ISIS would come back and retaliate. But Trich wanted to know what it felt like for women to taste their first moments of freedom. These women's stories were so much more harrowing than I expected, she says. They had hit rock bottom, were starving to death, traumatized, and yet defiantly they survived. Here she tells the stories of three women just beginning to enjoy their independence. And of course, this was photojournalist Aaron Treib, capital T-R-I-E-B. We thought we'd be burned alive. On a block of crumbling houses in West Mosul this spring, I met two cousins, Miami Fairies, 18, and Hojran Adnan, 16. I saw the girls waving from across the street, motioning me over. They invited me in for tea and began telling me what life was like before ISIS. Miami had been in school, and Hojran stayed at home with her parents. Both girls loved to dance and take selfies. When ISIS came 3 years ago, we learned quickly there were no jobs, no schools, no work. Miami's mother told me, Hojran and Miami spent their days inside. Going out could mean being confronted by militants. They can cut your head off if you do anything wrong, Hojran said. And this was no exaggeration. I learned of many families whose relatives were beheaded for breaking ISIS's rules, like owning a cell phone. But when the cousins did leave the house, they would often lift the black veil that concealed their eyes if they thought they were safe from militants and the Hezbollah, the ISIS religious police. If I got scared, Miami said, Hojran would tell me, ISIS won't do anything to you. They can go to H. The more we spoke, the more I realized how courageous these girls are. It's uncommon for teenage girls in Iraq to speak their minds freely. Hojran and Miami were fierce, as were their opinions. In February, the Iraqi army finally reached their neighborhood. But liberation did not come quickly. ISIS was positioned in their front yard. During the fighting, the family took cover in a basement for 10 days. We thought they'd burn us alive, Hojran said. When I met the girls, it had been only a week since they'd come out. Their neighbors were throwing a party. As they played music, sang, and danced, for the first time in 3 years, every act of freedom felt new. We'd let out 3 years of anxiety, said Miami. Hojran said, laughing, we can't even describe it. While life without ISIS means a return of certain liberties, the cousins know there are still limits. Even now, if I want to visit a friend or walk down a street alone, my family won't allow it, said Miami. But a boy can do whatever he wants. Why is it like this in our culture? We want to remove these restrictions. We want to live a normal life. And as we take a look from the vantage point of America, in a newly isolationist stance, thanks to Donald Trump. We are not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have removed our sovereignty. We are not in the Paris Climate Agreement, which would rob us of our money more and more and more. And we hope and pray that if Attorney General Jeff Sessions stays on, he will continue to do two things, be tough on the immigration and start to prosecute the real criminals from the Democratic National Committee milieu. But at the same time now, we know that something is on the move. The deep state is bringing in unauthorized Muslims. We've heard Captain Darrell Everhart report in on the governor authorizing these people being brought in to Western Pennsylvania. We know that there are many, many others being brought in. And this agenda has to stop. We do not want this. We brought last week the shocking news to all of you that in Smithfield, North Carolina, some well-meaning duped pastors sold a former Pentecostal church to become a mosque. And the Muslims gave them back the crosses. They didn't have any use for the crosses. And then, Lou, you reported on practically the Pilgrims Church, didn't you?
Yes, it was a church in Bridgeport, Connecticut, that is a congregational church. And the congregational church is the descendant of the original Puritan churches of New England and Massachusetts Bay in particular. This one in Bridgeport, Connecticut, had been sold, much like the one in Smithfield, North Carolina, and was going to become a mosque. And you just wonder, how in the world can this happen? But it's a sad state of affairs when there simply are not enough people attending church to keep the churches open. And that is, of course, the root cause of all this problem. But it's also the threat of the Islamic takeover. And people will say, well, they're a tiny, tiny fraction of the country. Yes, today they are. But what about the time of your children, grandchildren, and so forth?
Exactly. You know, we have a responsibility as watchmen on the wall, not just to warn our own generation, but to warn the progeny of those we love. I have nieces. And they have little children. Some of them have children. And, you know, I think about my father and mother, Charles and Margaret Cuppet. They were steadfast Republicans, and they did not like Bill Clinton. Even though my father played a trumpet, he didn't really like the saxophone player. You know, I tried to build up Bill Clinton. He's just a great guy. My father said, I don't like him. You know, there's that native intelligence that Americans have. Alexis de Tocqueville saw it in the 1800s, but you remember that famous quote in which he noticed that he was looking for the power everywhere he went. He looked in the state houses, he looked here, he looked there, but where he found the power was in the churches. And he said when that would cease to be true, America would no longer be great. And that's what we're struggling here for. Well, we know that President Trump may not be a perfect human being, but are you? Am I? Certainly not. But God has given us a reprieve. And when Trump tweets out that he doesn't want the transgender in the military, even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff gives a rebuttal later, Trump is right. If we didn't even think about the moral and spiritual issues, it's too confusing. It's too disruptive to our national security to have mixed up people, because they are mixed up people. Just look at Caitlyn Jenner. Look at the pictures. Is she happy? Is he happy? And I do have some sympathy. I do have some compassion and pity for these people. Alex Jones and others have brought out the thought, and there is some research on this, of the endocrine and other hormone disruptors, that these people may have a biological cause for some of what happens when they don't know whether they're a boy or a girl. No, God created us the way we should be, and in a fallen world, we wouldn't even have this issue to deal with. And so I do have sympathy, but you don't put people who are mixed up and unstable into the military, because that's to defend our country. But now, getting back to this threat of the radical Islam, we think that Europe is almost gone, and it breaks Lou's heart, my heart. As he said to you when he was reading an article about a week ago, Bradford in England, he said, why, gosh, that's where my ancestors lived. He had his ancestor John, who was living in Scotland in the year 1116. And, yes, we have a genealogical report from an ancestor who was a lawyer who went over in the mid-1800s, I think, to get a lot of this data. So John didn't even have a surname. It was so long ago. But he migrated up to England. And there he met the owner of the Calverley Manor. And that was spelled C-A-L-V-E-R-L-Y. And that lord of the manor had a daughter named Lardinia. And, of course, John fell in love with Lardinia, and they married. Now, I asked Lou whether the Calverley Manor was still there. He doesn't think so. He thinks there's a church there. But God forbid, will it soon be a mosque? Who knows? So I'm bringing this program to you. You know, I'm pretty much spending all of my retirement money to bring this to you. And God has been good. We are never starving. Sometimes we are greatly struggling. But just like one time, a long time back, I think before we were even doing our work against the New World Order, one summer we were struggling, and suddenly Lou realized he had something. What was it? Was it a bond?
Yes. At the church I attended at the time, it had a fundraiser in which we bought some bonds, and I had let the bond sit a long, long time without cashing it in, and all of a sudden we realized we had that.
It was $500.
And I believe it was $500.
So you see, just when we're at the end of our rope, something good will happen. Several times some of you have rescued us. Sometimes it was a gift of stamps, a few postage stamps sent. Yes, we can always use those. Sometimes it might have been a $20 bill, and just when we were wondering, how can we get the groceries? But we know that God is faithful. And when we're talking about radical Islam coming to our country, we're pleased that the Trump administration is trying to reverse some of the very, very, I want to say, treasonous activities of the administration before it, with bringing the Muslim Brotherhood in. And one of those things is the idea of Qatar. We have a little update here from Lou.
This is entitled, "A Bolder Saudi Arabia Targets Another Neighbor." Over the past 2 years, Saudi Arabia has become a source of conflict in the Middle East when it formerly was a quiet, rich, conciliatory force in the region. It is difficult to imagine a country less well-structured to wage war than Saudi Arabia. It is large in area, thinly populated, and ruled by an elite family, with most of its workforce consisting of foreigners. It is nonetheless well armed, thanks to its huge oil wealth, which has made it able to buy arms pretty much at will from the United States, the United Kingdom, and other suppliers. In spite of its considerable vulnerabilities, it has been able to wage, since March 2015, a fairly high-intensity destructive war in neighboring Yemen. An estimated 10,000 Yemenis have died, many as a direct or indirect result of Saudi airstrikes. More recently, Yemen has been struck with an epidemic of cholera, an estimated 300,000 cases fueled by the collapse of health care and infrastructure occasioned by Saudi bombing. It could not carry out the bombing without U.S. support through maintenance and aerial refueling. A newer Saudi enterprise undertaken after U.S. President Donald J. Trump gave it the green light in a May visit there, probably at the behest of Israel, is to force the Persian Gulf Emirate of Qatar to knuckle under the pressure from it, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, all Sunni Muslim-led states like Qatar. They have accused Qatar of supporting terrorism and wanted to change its policies radically. The four states imposed a blockade on Qatar last month and have made 13 demands, including the shutdown, including two shutdowns, Qatar media spearhead Al Jazeera ceased its cooperation with Saudi Arabia's Shiite Muslim enemy, Iran, cut various contacts with the Muslim Brotherhood, and links with Palestinian Hamas in Turkey, and its role as an intermediary among competing Afghanistan elements, including the Taliban. And that's reprinted from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Dr. Bob Glaze from the Southwest Radio Church Ministry, SWRC.com, had an important article November 2016, The Muslim Brotherhood's Strategic Plan for America. And now, you see, this was either prior to the election and the Trump win, or it was right after. But some of this is very important that I think you should know. He gives some background to us. The Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic terrorist organization founded in Ismailia, Egypt, by Hassan al-Banna in 1928. They rule by acts of terrorism, and their specialty is assassination. They have been declared a terrorist organization by Russia, Egypt, UAE, that's United Arab Emirates, and even Saudi Arabia. Their motto is Allah is our objective. The Prophet is our leader. The Quran is our law. Jihad is our way. Dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. Allahu Akbar. Their goals are as follows. The Brotherhood's goal is to turn the world into an Islamic empire. The Brotherhood wants America to fall. The Brotherhood claims Western democracy is corrupt, unrealistic, and false. The Brotherhood calls for jihad against Israel and the United States. The Brotherhood assassinated Anwar Sadat in 1981. Hamas is a wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood supports Hezbollah. The Brotherhood glorifies Osama bin Laden. The Brotherhood sanctions martyrdom. The Brotherhood advocates violent jihad. The Brotherhood advocates a deceptive strategy in democracies. The Brotherhood uses democracy, but once in power will replace it with Sharia law. The Brotherhood's view of women's rights is to subjugate. And we're all pretty familiar at this point that Valerie Jarrett was the senior White House advisor to President Obama, and that Hillary's closest advisor was Huma Abedin. All of these connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, there were many more. And Obama in 2013 had picked six prominent Muslim leaders to hold prominent offices in his administration. Arif Alakhan was Assistant Secretary for Policy Development for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Now, isn't that one? Do you recall that? How ironic that was. Mohammed El-Abiary, Homeland Security Advisor. Rashad Hussein, Special Envoy to the Organization of the Islamic Conference. Salam al-Mariat, founder of Muslim Public Affairs Council, Imam Mohammed Majid, Obama's Sharia czar. Now, what in the world did we have having our U.S. president having a Sharia czar? Good night. And Abu Patel represented the Advisory Council on Faith-Based Neighborhood Partnerships. And there again, see the takeover of the interfaith movement. The connection to Muslim organizations to White House fairs, Bob Glaze says, is well established. It will continue. And here, he said, if Hillary won. And Judicial Watch, he quotes that there were documents stating that the Brotherhood plans to take over the United States. This document is revealed to the public by the Clarion Project. At clarionproject.org, that's spelled capital C-L-A-R-I-O-N. The document is entitled The Muslim Brotherhood's Strategic Plan for America, court document. And this document was entered as evidence in the 2008 Holy Land Terror funding trial. Federal investigators found the document in the home of Ismail El-Baras, a founder of the Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Falls Church, Virginia. During a 2004 search, El-Baras was a member of the Palestine Committee, which the Muslim Brotherhood had created to support Hamas in the United States. Some of the following quotes are taken directly from this 18-page document. It is presented in both English and Arabic at the above internet address. Lou's going to give you this excerpt. Remember, this was taken from this document that was entered as evidence in the 2008 Holy Land Terror Funding Trial.
Enablement of Islam in North America, meaning establishing an effective and a stable Islamic movement led by the Muslim Brotherhood, which adopts Muslims' causes domestically and globally, and which works to expand the observant Muslim base, aims at unifying and directing Muslims' efforts, presents Islam as a civilization alternative, and supports the global Islamic State wherever it is. That was from page 4. From page 5, the movement must plan and struggle to obtain the keys, and that's in quotation marks, the keys and the tools of this process in carrying out this grand mission as a, quote, civilization jihadist responsibility, unquote. From page 7, the process of settlement is a civilization jihadist process, also in quotes, with all the word means. The Ikhwan, Muslim Brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and, quote, sabotaging, unquote, its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers. We must possess a mastery of the art of coalitions, the art of absorption, and the principles of cooperation. Again, that's from page 7 of this document. From page 18, a list of our organizations and the organizations of our friends. Dash. This is where the Muslim Brotherhood listed its front groups in the U.S., including ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, MSA, Muslim Students Association, MYNA, Muslim Youth of North America, MCA, the Muslim Communities Association, AMSE, Association of Muslim Scientists and Engineers, and ITC, Islamic Teaching Center.
So you see, listeners, whether or not the administrations change, if there is a deep state momentum, it's connected to that plan to bring down Europe with all of that George Soros money being fed in with the UN connections. All of this is, you see, somewhat subterranean, but you have to be aware of this. Brother Tiernan, Matt Tiernan, with his newsletter, Tribulation Watch Newsletter, at P.O. Box 182085, again, that's P.O. Box 182085, Arlington, Texas, 76096, has a very important article in his July issue. Did you know America is being devoured by strangers? In Isaiah chapter 1, we read these words, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land, strangers devour it in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers, Isaiah 1:7. With a close study of Isaiah chapter 1, you will find that the sins of America are no different than the sins of ancient Israel. No doubt the promised judgment will be the same. Like ancient Israel, America today is being devoured by strangers, foreigners. One of the best examples is Dearborn, Michigan. Many call it Dearbornistan or Little Baghdad. Dearborn, Michigan, a city of 100,000, has fully embraced its Arab American Muslim inhabitants, which make up 44% of the city's population, as well as some of the dangerous ideas of Sharia law. Polygamy is illegal here in the U.S., but what about immigrants, strangers, who already have more than one wife? According to American Freedom Fighters, AFF, these men are listing 2, 3, and 4. Yes, they are allowed 4 wives each as, quote, extended family when qualifying for welfare and other government programs. This means, instead of assimilating into American culture, Muslim men in Michigan are continuing to adhere to Sharia law, which, by the way, allows men to beat their wives' property. In other words, they're like property, while at the same time taking advantage of taxpayer dollars. The Arabic language has become so common in Michigan that the Michigan Department of Human Services, which residents must call when applying for food stamps, prompts callers to press 1 for English, 2 for Spanish, and 3 for Arabic. Call them and hear for yourself. The number is 1-888-678-8914. Just press 3 when the recording first starts. It will automatically switch over to the Arabic language. Muslim refugees are getting big money from welfare, more than disabled American citizens get, free clothing, housing, and vehicles. Muslims in Dearborn live in $200,000-plus homes and drive $60,000-plus expensive cars. Islamic businesses with Arabic letters are everywhere. Muslim women and children... Muslim women and girls walk around in expensive Muslim garb, not smiling or friendly. In mosques, they are taught that Americans are their enemies. These large welfare, quote, families are an unnecessary and illegal drain on the nation's struggling economy. But liberal news sources like the Huffington Post have been quick to applaud Dearborn for making peace with its unusually high Muslim population. The HuffPost article, linked below, praises Michigan schools for, quote, beating the odds, and, quote, sending Dearborn's poorest students off to Yale, Harvard, and top schools nationwide in disproportionate numbers. End of quote. The article describes Dearborn's Arab and Muslim populations as Democrat through and through. So you can bet these college educations are fully funded by taxpayer dollars. While the Huffington Post paints an idealistic version of Dearborn, Stan, other sources expose the violence that stems from Sharia law. For example, the Clarion Project reports that Christians waving signs about Christianity were attacked in June 2012 at the Dearborn, Michigan Arab Festival. The perpetrators assaulted the Christians verbally and physically and threw stones at them. The local police force was criticized but not punished for simply asking the Christians to leave and taking no action against the violent mob. This cannot be tolerated, reports AFF. Muslims who partake of America's generous public assistance programs should be held to the same standards as every other American. That means multiple wives can't be claimed, nor should food banks be required to provide special halal food for Muslims, as Muslims in Minnesota are demanding. Side note, Sharia law is based on the Quran and the Sunnah, the words and deeds of Muhammad, and that's spelled capital S-H-U-N-N-A-H. And according to Sahih al-Bukhari, who is regarded by Muslims as the most reliable early biography of their prophet, the founder of Islam married one of his wives, Aisha, when she was 6 years old, and consummated that marriage when she was 9. Also, it is legal to behead children under Sharia law for simply refusing to fast properly during the month of Ramadan. America must wake up. We cannot allow this evil religious system to be practiced in country. We would really agree with Matt Tiemann on this exceptional newsletter. Again, Tribulation Watch newsletter in Arlington, Texas, P.O. Box 182085. And he has a little bit more about what's happening in the South Carolina school system.
A South Carolina elementary school is under the microscope after a parent realized her sixth grade child was tasked with a Five Pillars of Islam worksheet. Alston Middle School in Somerville, South Carolina, has a class called Survey of Civilization, which includes lesson plans on different religions, economies, and geographic regions. a local CBS affiliate, was recently sent a classroom assignment that has some parents angry that they weren't given more details beforehand. Said one mother, who chose to remain anonymous for the story, quote, "Our concern is that if they need permission to teach sexual education, they should be getting permission to teach religious values," unquote. And the station reported that on February the 3rd. The worksheet requires students to know the following. One, and these are in quotes, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." Two, "Pray 5 times a day and visit a mosque on Fridays." Three, "Give alms to the poor, to the needy." Four, "Fast from sunrise to sunset during the month of Ramadan." And five, "Make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your lifetime." One section of the worksheet instructed students to match certain passages from the Quran with the pillar it most closely supports. One of the questions in that section quoted a verse from the Quran which reads, "Allah, there is no God but Him, the living, the eternal one, neither slumber nor sleep overtakes Him," unquote. The correct corresponding pillar for that particular passage was the first pillar of Islam, which states, "Proclaim there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." Another section is students fill in the blanks. One statement, once completed, referred to Islam as a, quote, "religion of peace," unquote. Another blank instructed students to say how Muslims feel that, quote, "a few people of my religion committed terrorist acts," unquote. Pupils were also asked to circle whether Muslims do or do not believe in terrorists' idea of a holy war. Similar Islamic indoctrination has been taking place across the nation in public schools. Instances such as California, Florida, Tennessee, and Minnesota, where students either sang songs about Ramadan, complete with the lyrics, "Allahu Akbar," designed a Muslim prayer rug, or wrote down the five pillars of Islam, including, "All people must submit to Allah." It was getting so bad in Tennessee, lawmakers introduced a bill in 2015 to curb the amount of time spent on Islamic lessons. CARE, Council for American Islamic Relations, called the move anti-Islam, but parents across the Bible Belt state had been concerned that more time was spent covering the doctrines of Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, but not Christianity. Usually that topic was reserved for when the class studied Hinduism, but not Christianity. I think there's a misprint here. We got the one line, I think, this is typed twice. Usually that topic was reserved for when the class studied the Age of Exploration and learned how Christians persecuted others in Western Europe. And the author says, God bless you, friends. Stay alert. The enemy is on the march.
And Western Christian civilization has a whole different viewpoint. Its viewpoint is the individual is worth all. And next week we will tell you about the Art of the Hostage deal. For once, Time magazine has a great article on President Trump's efforts to free Americans held captive abroad. We'll be bringing that. We'll be bringing you the impetus toward focusing on taxes. We have a lot more to bring you. We're just running out of time. This hour passes so quickly. But we ask you to continue to pray for Donald Trump and for General John Kelly, the new chief of staff. We hope this will prevent any type of hideous coup that is planned. God Almighty is in charge. We can trust in Him. His will be done. Good night.